on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old Bill Gornick of Meridian, Idaho. He grew up in Pennsylvania, one of eight children. He's a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross, the Air Medal, and the Bronze Star after an Air Force career that spanned the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam eras. Time to hear now about his time as an engineer gunner on B-25 bombers with the 491st Bomb Squadron in China. Take me back 70 years, Bill. What was it like flying in a B-25?
The one who trained in the most was with the H model, which had the cannon in it. I preferred that because it was more exciting. Firing most of the missions when you flew in the H model were low-level missions where you're strafing, firing the cannon at railroad cars or sampans and shipping, and it's low-level. A lot of the missions were not much higher than this building.
Wow.
You know, it's low-level stuff, and almost like in a fighter plane.
Yeah.
And because you had a tremendous firepower, so a lot of the missions were low-level. But I would say at least 10 or 12 of my missions were high-level at night, where we were bombing targets in airdromes in eastern China, Hong Kong and Canton airfields. Those were kind of hairy because we flew as lone wolf. In other words, you took off at 5-minute intervals or 10-minute intervals. So as you were flying, say, about 10,000 feet, which was high altitude for us,
right,
you were 5 minutes after the guy that's ahead of you, and you could see them shooting.
You could see the tracers
heading
for the plane in front of you.
And they're blowing up, and you knew you were next.
So you saw where the anti-aircraft guns were pointed and knew you were going to have to fly through it.
Yeah, and searchlights.
Mm-hmm.
And one time it got us in a searchlight, and it looked like it was just pointing right at us, period. But never got shot. Of all the, you might say, enjoyable flights, one night where the sky was completely covered with clouds, and we were above the clouds, and it was full moon night, and it was just like snow. It was just beautiful.
So the moon was reflecting off the tops of the clouds, and you guys were above the clouds.
Yeah, how it felt up in an open turret, you know, a really funny feeling.
And explain that to people. You mentioned the turret, so some people listening might be trying to picture in their mind how a B-25 is set up. Explain to them where you would be on one of these missions, and then what kinds of things you're doing through the course of a mission.
Okay, something really almost disastrous happened here because the position I had was in a top turret, and the position is right behind the pilot and co-pilot. Your guns, you could rotate it 360 degrees. We did a lot of going after bridges as our target, and we used to call that kind of like glip bombing. It's a combination of glide and skip.
Glip bombing. I've heard of glide bombing and skip bombing.
Yeah.
But not glip bombing.
It was glide and skip. And when a pilot starts his run, you know, you're coming in low level. And the idea was to hit the bomb at the base of the, once he starts his run, he can't vary.
Right.
So it was my job then, one mission in particular, there was gun emplacements on both sides of the bridge. And it was my job then to strafe or knock out those two gun emplacements. And as the pilot was making his run, I was shooting at one, and I just kept my finger on the trigger and strafed going like this.
So you've got one on your right and one on your left, and you're rotating from one to the other to try to get both guns.
Yeah, well, what happened is as I was going across, the top hatch on the B-25 had a press-in latch where you could, from outside, to open the if you're outside, like on the ground, and you want to open the hatch, you just press that down.
So that hatch is between your gun and the nose of the airplane.
Right. And so I'm shooting over the hatch, and as I was coming across, the muzzle blast pressed that latch down, and off came the hatch. Now the muzzle blast is going down into the cockpit. It all happened so fast, and the pilot screamed, you know, to me over the interphone, quit shooting, because, you know, and he never varied. He just kept straight. We knocked the bridge out, but it could have been disastrous if we had lost control of the airplane.
Yeah.
We're on, you know, on deck.
There's not a whole lot of margin for error, because you're diving down at this position, real low altitude, and the muzzle blast from your machine gun on top of that plane had the potential to injure him or blind him.
Well, no, the noise.
Deafen him?
Yeah.
But you caught it in time.
Hatch came off, and I quit shooting.
That's certainly a hair-raising moment, that mission that you describe. And I'm sure among 46 missions over there in China, there were some that you might reflect on as pretty close calls. What were the scariest moments for you?
That was one of the bad ones. Missions that we were around Hainan Island, which is out on the China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
We went after shipping. They were hairy because Hainan Island had a lot of fighter planes. Other than that, it wasn't all that bad. I had one mission, for example, at night, low level at night, because we were after sampans going up down the river. We felt a thump. We thought we got hit by ground fire. We got out of the airplane when we landed, got back to our base, got out, looked at the airplane over, and all we could see is that IFF antenna, which is about that long, underneath the bottom of the airplane. It was laying flat against the skin, which means that we hit something. That's how low we were. We might have hit a tree or something.
Mm-hmm.
At another time, we had 136 holes in the airplane.
Was that all?
And nobody got a scratch. This didn't happen to me, but on another airplane, on another flight, one bullet hit the airplane, a single bullet, and it hit the radio man and killed him.
Yeah, so one bullet is enough to take someone's life, and your plane one time came back with 136 holes.
Yeah.
When you're flying one of those real low-altitude missions, and you know that not only is there a better chance of getting hit, but there's a better chance that the hit is going to be pretty severe and forceful at that low altitude. What does that feel like to make that run? What's going through your mind in those tense moments?
It seems to me I always had faith in the pilot. Even though one time we were attacking a railroad train, we were two of us, two airplanes. And as we passed over and we were making a turn around, the other guy, all of a sudden, when he made his turn down, it went right into the ground. It blew up. He had a stall.
And you mentioned enemy fighter planes. So it's one thing when you're trying to take out guns on the ground and you're dealing with that anti-aircraft fire. How often did you guys see enemy aircraft in your neighborhood?
Very seldom. Because I'll tell you why. The Japanese had a lot of respect for the B-25. First of all, they were heavily armed, plus the fact they were fast.
Mm-hmm.
And they're flying low. The 14th Air Force also had B-24s.
Right.
And they're slow and lumbering, and they were high. And they were a lot more vulnerable to fighter planes than we were.
So they knew their odds of shooting down a B-24 were better than shooting down a B-25.
Right, yeah.
You ever run into people when we tell them about what you did that they didn't even know that we were in China during World War II? Because everyone talks about Europe and the Pacific.
Yeah. And in fact, when I talked to what we call the bridging the generation gap, I guess over the last 10 or 12 years, I've talked to at least 12,000 students.
Wow.
You know, because they bring in classes in here and we talk to them.
Right here at the War Hawk Air Museum. The students come here and you give them a lecture.
Yeah. Have all the kids sit out here. And a couple of times I've did this. Instead of waiting for them to ask me a question, I said, I have a question for you guys. How many of you people have ever heard of Stalin? How many of you heard of Hitler? How many have heard of Chiang Kai-shek? Mute. Nobody.
So they raise their hands when you say Stalin and Hitler, but nothing, no response.
No, land-wise, that was the biggest theater of World War II, the Far East.
Well, what do you think it's important for us to know about you and all those other guys who were doing that important work in that part of the world?
To begin with, the Japanese started the war way back before 1936.
Mm-hmm.
Not too many people knew about the Orient. A lot of people don't know, for example, at that time, about the Communist Party. A lot of people don't know this, but during World War II, there were no blacks military in China.
Mm-hmm.
China Kai-shek and Mao Zedong wouldn't allow it. And then you were mostly lived off the land. China was completely surrounded by Japanese. So there was no shipping into China.
Mm-hmm.
Everything came over the hump, Himalayas, by air.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, you were lucky to get your mail. Very seldom we got any food. The priority was bombs and gasoline. We took it as it came. You know, it was no big deal. You make fun out of eating eggs, boiled, eating eggs, scrambled, eating eggs every way you can make them. But ate a lot of eggs and a lot of water buffalo meat.
Because there were chickens and there were water buffalo.
That's right.
Uh-huh. I bet you never had water buffalo in Pennsylvania.
No. Yeah.
What does it taste like, by the way?
It it's like a tough meat. You forget how a nice red steak is.
Well, you certainly know that up here in Idaho.
You know, we didn't have sophisticated anti-aircraft guns, but, you know, we were bombing the Japanese, and obviously they were bombing us, too.
Right.
They had a system, an alert system, referred to as the Jingbao system. It had a pole with so many balls. You know, if you had a one ball, that means there's a possibility of being bombed. And if it's two ball, so forth. And if it's four ball, they're here.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, it had a radio system, alert. And now, since we didn't have our own real fancy anti-aircraft facilities.
On your base, you mean?
On the base.
Yeah.
Every day, if your name was on that bulletin board that day that there's going to be an air raid, it was your duty to go man the anti-aircraft guns. There's nothing more than a hole in the ground like a pit about 4 feet deep and about 6 feet, 8 feet in diameter with 250 caliber machine guns. It was your job, instead of going to caves or slit trenches, you manned those guns. On this particular day, when it came over, the Japanese, instead of dropping demolition bombs like they normally do, they were dropping anti-personnel bombs. And these anti-personnel bombs, we called them banana bombs. I don't know how the name came, but the way they work, it would probably drop them out of the airplane in a cluster. Then spread these little bomblets, like or banana bombs that we call them, and they would come down like rain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on this particular raid, when I was manning the guns, of course, the 50 caliber big machine guns, from the ground, it have to be pretty close to be effective. So you're really doing a lot of shooting for nothing.
And anyhow, you could be safer in a trench or in a cave.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, this one, as they were coming over, they were coming down, and these little bombers were exploding all over the place, just like rain coming down. And all of a sudden, I heard this plop, and I looked over, and there's one of these banana bombs laying about 2 feet away from my head as I was in that bed. And I could see that this little propeller that's supposed to come out when it comes down and that arms it so that when the bomb hits the ground, this firing pin sets off the booster that sets off the main charge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I could see that this propeller was still partially inserted. It didn't fall off. So I just reached over and gently turned it back in with my finger. Now I had a complete bomb. And so the next morning, I took the bomb apart. The bottom part screws off. That's the explosive charge. This part is the booster. When you took this apart, the booster came out in my hand. I just threw it as far as I could, and it exploded as soon as it hit the ground. The other part, I just took a knife, and I just scraped it a little bit. It made a little bit of loose powder, put a match to it, and it just burns. The only way it would set it off would be an explosive. So it just burned off, and now I had a complete bomb. And I actually brought that bomb. I had a picture of it here.
Well, and you have a replica of it on display here at the War Hawk Air Museum. Well, I want to ask you more about this. So you described that real nonchalantly. But you said this bomb, and these were anti-personnel bombs, so they would hit, and then they would just throw shrapnel everywhere. So
right.
If it landed in a crowd of 10 guys, it could wound all 10 guys kill several of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it hit the ground 2 feet away from your head?
Yeah.
What would have happened to you if it had gone off?
I probably wouldn't be here.
And that's not exaggeration. It would have shredded you. So what do you think happened?
Well, it probably had that little screw, eccentric screw. Probably had a little burr in it or something. It was, poor product. It never came all the way out.
I don't want to be melodramatic, but do you think somebody was looking out for you?
I think so.
Before I forget, I want to ask you about Honor Flight, because you were part of the first Idaho Honor Flight.
Mm-hmm.
They took you back to Washington, D.C. You saw the National World War II Memorial. What did you think about when you were at that memorial and when you saw all those gold stars for all the guys who didn't come home?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question, because one of the greatest and nicest things that ever happened to me in my life, and I get tears in my eyes even trying to talk about it, was I was asked to lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. To me, that's extremely emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I can't, that's why I was crying.
Mm-hmm. Did you think about, while you were there on that trip, and I know it was a great occasion, and mm-hmm. you got to enjoy it with other veterans and share that experience, and the people of Idaho made it possible for you to go, and I'm sure that's humbling, mm-hmm. but did you find yourself thinking about those guys from your original B-25 crew who died over there, who have never been found?
That's right. Oh, yeah. I never forget them. In fact, I joined the POWMIA, and I flag. I live in a gated community, and I always pay for a new, when it wears out, the POWMIA flag, along with the American flag.
In honor of those three crewmates of yours?
Yeah.
Because they've never been recovered. They've never been found.
No.
You ever think about what their lives might have been like if they got to come home and have a family like you did?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the radio man's mother came to visit me after when I came home.
What'd you tell her?
I couldn't tell her anything. I couldn't, you know, except how much I felt for her and him. He was a super nice guy. All of them were, you know, just like I say, it would have been really easy to lay your life down for him. If necessary.
And I know that nobody listening right now doubts that one bit. Time for another break, but when we come back, how did a 48-year-old Bill Gornick talk his way into a bombing mission in the Vietnam War? He is one determined guy. We'll also find out more about the museum he loves so much in Nampa, Idaho. You can find tons of photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and hometownheroesradio.com. The rest of Bill's story right after this.